Hello from Boston. I'm Marco Werman, and this is Boston Calling from the BBC. It's the program that puts a global perspective on the American experience. Great to be with you again. This week, an artist touch from the Chinese activist Ai Weiwei and his Zodiac Heads exhibit.
They stand on poles. The smallest weighs 800 pounds. The largest weighs about 1,500 pounds, and they're 10 feet in the air.
To a young Afghan musician who fought an arranged marriage on the mic.
Rap music lets you tell your story to other people. Rap music is a platform to share the words that are in my heart.
Plus, we enter the world of artisanal perfume and find out why some perfume makers want you to describe their products like this.
Fecal, uriny, barnyardy. It's really, it can be a compliment to a perfumer.
Well, there's a fishy story. Sorry. Couldn't help myself. Those three stories and a handful more coming up, but first on this week's art-themed edition of Boston Calling, we're going to hear from David Guttenfelder. He's a photojournalist with more than a decade of war reporting. Guttenfelder's worked in hotspots like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Congo, and he returned to the U.S. a little more than a year ago. But he kept finding connections between his new life here and his old life as a war photographer. That's partly why he became involved with Mission 22. It's an advocacy campaign that deals with the high rate of suicide among former U.S. soldiers. Their slogan says it all. The American military's deadliest battleground isn't some remote stretch of desert across the globe. It's here at home. I asked David Guttenfelder about his work.
I spent pretty much my entire adult life living outside of the United States, and I was a combat photographer. I spent the entire Afghanistan war working in Afghanistan, working in Iraq, working with service men and women. And when I came home, I had devoted so much of my career and my life to that I started looking around here in the United States, and I realized that I had only covered part of the story. And I had not ever, really looked into what's happening to all of these people who I met out in the field and what's happened to them now that they've come back to the United States. And I discovered this shocking statistic, 22 American veterans killing themselves every day in the United States.
You did visit the homes of five service members who had committed suicide. You met with their families. Just reading some of the accounts, it sounds really intense. But there was one family you visited with, and you discovered this connection with their son who had killed himself. Can you tell us that story?
Honestly, I had been embedded with so many different groups of soldiers and Marines that, I had a connection with all of them, honestly. But there was one young man in particular. His name was Brandon Ladner. And we'd gone to his mother's house, the house where she lives now, where he had lived in Alabama. And she was talking about his experience in Afghanistan. And I stopped her and I said, Renee, I was there. I was on that battle. I must have been there when your son was there. And it was very, very emotional for her and for me. And she was crying and she said, please tell me about it. Brandon would never tell me about that. He would always say, oh, Mama, you don't want to know about those terrible things. It was very intense. I went to these homes to meet the families and to photograph the spaces where these suicides happened and to try to give meaning to this different kind of battlefield. But most of the time when I was there, I wasn't taking pictures. I was sitting on their couches and talking to them about their sons and trying to help them understand.
It sounds in some ways, David, like this whole project kind of traumatized you a little bit.
Well, I would never compare my own experience to theirs, but I was out there for so long that I was in it for so long that when I came back, I hadn't really ever taken time to digest a lot of it and to take stock of a lot of it. But now, forgive me for a minute, and this is all about trying to get people to understand this statistic that's really almost impossible to believe.
Mm. The thing that kept on occurring to me as I looked at your photographs, as a photojournalist covering war, many of your images were, people in action, dynamic, and these pictures are really different. They're static. There are no people, and if we didn't have a caption, these would be black and white shots of Americana and suburbia, but how do you convey all that has happened in these images?
Yeah, that was the difficult thing. I'm obviously not a architectural photographer. I went into these houses to sit in these spaces where these terrible things happened and find a way to photograph it so that when others see it, they can feel it. But also to try and show the absence. I mean, these are not battlefields like Iraq and Afghanistan and kinetic action. These are just very simple, mundane places where people live, but they're empty, they're absent. And I was just really trying to show that really terrifying irony that the most deadly battle space is something so incredibly ordinary to everyone.
David Guttenfelder, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Our next story is also about war and what it looks like through an artistic lens. It's about a new work of fiction, a spy thriller that's been getting some buzz for bringing a fresh eye to the Vietnam War. The book is called The Sympathizer, and it's a debut novel of Viet Thanh Nguyen. Our own Monica Campbell met up with Nguyen and spoke to him about his book and his own life in America as a Vietnamese refugee.
The main character doesn't have a name. He's just the captain. And the book reads like his confession.
I'm a spy, a sleeper, a spook, a man of two faces.
That's Viet Thanh Nguyen reading the first line of The Sympathizer. The captain is a spy for the North Vietnamese Army. After Saigon falls in 1975, or liberated, he'd say, he flees with South Vietnamese refugees to California to spy on their efforts to take back their homeland.
And this was a story that I had not made up, but was something that was actually happening, at least in terms of that effort by the South Vietnamese to continue fighting the war after the war ended.
In the U.S., the captain's world is split between the refugees he's spying on and his allegiance to communist Vietnam.
So his one talent, he says, is the capacity to sympathize with people, feeling for all the different participants in this horrible conflict.
The book is also about being new to the U.S., something Nguyen knows well. He was 4 when his family fled Vietnam in 1975. They eventually settled in San Jose, California.
My own parents were hardcore Catholics who were basically business people, mostly interested in survival. But even from them, I would hear, terrible stories about the effects of history and the war and the trauma that had affected everybody around us.
He also remembers seeing Hollywood Vietnam films in the 80s, like Apocalypse Now.
There is a turning point in the movie halfway through where the boatload of American sailors is going up a river and encounters a sampan full of innocent Vietnamese civilians and massacres them. At the moment when these people are being killed, I felt as if I was in their place as well, so that even years later when I would describe this scene in this movie to other people, my voice would shake with anger and rage.
The book also shows the bonds among Vietnamese immigrants, adapting or not to life in America. The captain himself is a bit of a mess, a drunk, a womanizer, a murderer even. And his close friend from Vietnam, who lost his family in the war, never feels a part of the United States. He says he feels like America is a house he's hiding in.
One of the things I wanted to do in the novel was to focus intensely on what it meant for these people to lose everything and come to the United States and feel both embittered and also not able to talk about their bitterness in public, at least in public outside of the Vietnamese community, because they were afraid of what Americans were thinking, and they knew that Americans wanted them to express gratitude, which is certainly something that many of them felt, but it was an emotion that was layered in with many other emotions that remained unspoken in English.
Finally, Nguyen says it's work by Toni Morrison and Ralph Ellison that's influenced him. He even named his son Ellison. He says The Invisible Man was in his head a lot when he wrote this book, for its version of history and its rage. There's anger in The Sympathizer, too.
Because I felt as if I was telling the truth as I saw it. And I just had to trust that there would be other people who would find this story to be resonant.
And fair to say, a safe assumption. That was Viet Thanh Nguyen, the author of The Sympathizer, ending our story from Monica Campbell. Next up on this Artist Touch edition of the program, the story of a young woman who escaped being a 14-year-old bride by rapping about the culture of selling girls to the highest bidder in her native Afghanistan. Now this woman is living here in the U.S., going to school in the western state of Utah. And as Shuka Kalantari reports, she's still making music about social justice back home.
Sonita Alizadeh is standing in front of a children's playground in Berkeley, California. We met earlier that day. Sonita flew into town to perform her first U.S. concert. We were taking a walk when she suddenly stopped to stare at a man playing with his two daughters.
Here in America, a father sets aside time to take his daughter out to the park. Where I come from, you don't see that.
Sonita comes from Afghanistan. She's 18 years old, has long black hair, a small frame, and if things had gone according to her parents' plan, she would have been married by now.
Sometimes I think about the fact that I could have been a mother right now with a few kids. It's not a thought I like.
Sonita grew up in Tehran, Iran's capital city. Her family fled Afghanistan when she was 8 years old because of war. Sonita found a nonprofit that taught undocumented Afghan kids. There she learned karate, photography, guitar, and she started singing and rapping. Sonita's music quickly got her recognition. She met an Iranian director who helped her polish up her style and make music videos. And that led to a few awards. Everything was perfect. Until it wasn't.
One day my mom told me, "You have to return to Afghanistan with me. There's a man there that wants to marry you. Your brother is engaged and we need your dowry money to pay for his wedding."
Sonita was devastated. So she wrote the song, "Brides for Sale." The song begins, "Let me whisper, so no one hears that I speak of selling girls. My voice shouldn't be heard, since it's against Sharia. Women must remain silent. This is our tradition." The video shows Sonita wearing a wedding dress, with a barcode on her forehead. Her face is bruised. She pleads with her family not to sell her off. Sonita was worried about what her parents would think about the video, but they actually loved it. And they also told her that she didn't have to get married.
It means so much to me that my family went against our tradition for me. Now I'm somewhere that I never imagined I could be.
The attention around Sonita's music landed her a full scholarship to an arts academy in Utah, and that led to her first concert here in the San Francisco Bay Area. But before the show, Sonita needs to rehearse. We hop into my car and drive to nearby West Oakland. The rehearsal studio is in a neighborhood covered in graffiti. Both sides of the street are lined with homeless people. Sonita is shocked, because it reminds her of home.
I grew up in a neighborhood where everybody was poor. The houses were run down. I couldn't go outside at night because it was really dangerous. Are you telling me in America there are places where you can't walk alone at night too? Then where in the world can people go to find a safe home? Rap music lets you tell your story to other people. Rap music is a platform to share the words that are in my heart.
And sometimes, rap music is a way to express a sadness, an anger, that Afghan women are told they're not supposed to show. Even though Sonita now lives over 7,000 miles away from home, she says she'll always sing about what's closest to her heart, the people of Afghanistan.
That story from Shuka Kalantari in California. And you are listening to Boston Calling on the BBC World Service with me, Marco Werman. We're the program that connects the dots between America and the rest of the world in all kinds of surprising ways. And if you enjoyed that last musical segment, stick around because later on the program, we've got a story about the musical duo Niaz and their latest album. It was inspired by the first female Sufi mystic.
Most of our music in Niyaz is dedicated to the plight of ethnic and religious minority groups in and around Iran. So then the idea was, well, let's dedicate the album to the greatest minority group in the world, and that's women.
But first, on this Artist Touch edition of the program, let's talk about a product that's small batch, handcrafted, and in keeping with our theme, artisanal, not beer. I'm talking perfume. Yeah, I know, fragrance is not the easiest topic for the radio, but our good friend Alina Simone is going to give it a shot. She takes us to Brooklyn in New York City to look at the growing niche market for micro-perfumeries.
At Twisted Lily, a fragrance boutique in Brooklyn, I learned that when you're talking about perfume, things quickly get personal. Like when co-owner Eric Weiser explains why I won't like one of his favorite perfumes.
It has one word, is the name, and it's Sturcus.
Sturcus, in case your Latin is rusty, means feces. I think it smells nice.
It's quite lovely, isn't it?
It is. It doesn't smell fecal at all. It's really, and that's just one of the words perfume fanatics reach for to describe something that smells really great.
You skunky, dirty, fecal, uriny, barnyardy. It's really, it can be a compliment to a perfumer.
Asking personal questions of a perfumer is actually what brings me to Twisted Lily today. They're unveiling a new scent by Hiram Green, a perfumer based in the Netherlands. Most of the perfumes sold here don't come from Chanel or Christian Dior. They are handmade by individual perfumers, most of whom are self-taught, which I found striking. I mean, how does one go about joining this mysterious, self-initiating cult?
Well, it hasn't been easy or a quick quest.
Hiram Green spent 10 years experimenting with natural oils before finally launching his perfume line. Before becoming a perfumer, he ran his own perfume shop in London. People kept coming in asking for all-natural perfume, free of synthetics. But there just wasn't much out there.
Chanel No. 5 or a lot of the perfumes that you buy in department stores, although they may smell like flowers, they don't necessarily contain the essences of the natural flowers.
It really did become a quest. His perfumes took years of trial and error to develop. In part because there's no perfume textbook, no ideal scent, Hiram explains. Just you, chasing down your own unique olfactory dream. And that can get pretty abstract.
Night Surf is not meant to smell like anything that already exists in the world.
This is Aliyah Raza. Last year, she and her partner, Ezra Wood, launched their new perfume company, Régime des Fleurs, in Los Angeles.
Think of like a orange blossom, but on steroids, like very, very extra special, bright, almost industrial cleaner, highlighter markers, orange Tic Tacs, like, but with a feeling of orange blossom as well.
I can't say Night Surf conjured the same hyper-specific references for me, but when I sample Floralia, a fragrance meant to evoke a white marble statue. Oh my God, that totally smells like white marble.
That's what everybody says.
I can even smell the white. I don't even know how.
100%. Everybody says that's white marble.
Perfumers are actually painting with scent, I realize. And as with painters and punk rockers, being self-taught can be a mark of pride.
By its very nature, what we do is going to be experimental and different and weird and out of the box.
And making experimental, even radical, perfumes means critics won't always approve. A trained nose expects perfume to have certain characteristics and to unfold in a specific way. One critic described Régime des Fleurs' perfume Waterwood as an artless cavalcade.
We wanted to make the smell of a forest underwater, and so we did it.
And people who want to smell like underwater forests agree. It's their best seller.
Smells like a story Alina Simone could have only sent from New York. Next up on this Artist Touch edition of the program, we're going to talk about the Chinese activist Ai Weiwei. China still considers him so controversial that they don't allow him to leave the country. But that doesn't mean his art has to stay put. In fact, he's currently got an exhibition in, of all places, the small town of Jackson in the western state of Wyoming. Now, you're probably already thinking wide open spaces, cowboys, and the like. Truth is, only around 9,500 people call Jackson home. But now they've been joined by a series of gigantic bronze sculptures done by Ai Weiwei. The works are the heads of traditional Chinese zodiac creatures, rat and rooster, snake and dog, to name just four. To learn more about the exhibition, I got in touch with Jim McNutt. He's a president of the National Museum of Wildlife Art, the temporary home for Ai Weiwei's work. So walk us through Ai Weiwei's Zodiac Head exhibit. These are animals and I suppose figurines related to the 12 signs of the Zodiac. It's outdoors, right?
It is outdoors. These are big pieces. Something like if you held your hands around a great big tree, you would be thinking about something like this. They stand on poles. The smallest weighs 800 pounds. The largest weighs about 1,500 pounds, and they're 10 feet in the air. And they're extremely expressive in themselves. You're not just looking at a picture of a rat, but the rat is looking at you and saying something, and you begin to wonder very quickly what it is. And when you see the dragon, you start backing up across the road. It's a pretty fierce-looking thing.
I know Jackson gets a lot of people visiting, but it's a small town still. What does it mean for Jackson to have this exhibit?
Well, Jackson is a destination place already because it's the southern gateway to Grand Teton and Yellowstone National Parks. And having it here, there's a special relationship in the United States between the continued presence of big wildlife, moose and bison and bear and so on and so forth, and this art that is in our museum and is now outside the museum and in all of its different representations.
Yeah, that's an interesting juxtaposition. I mean, Ai Weiwei doesn't just do animal sculptures, though. There's always meaning. What does this work mean, do you think?
Well, I think what Ai Weiwei did, and as we've learned about it, it really is fascinating because he's taken something that is of historic moment in China. The originals of these figures were part of a zodiac display at a Chinese palace that was looted by the British and French in 1860 during the Second Opium War. But Ai Weiwei knew from images what this beautiful palace looked like and then reconstructed his own versions of the heads. And it's actually really fascinating. If you look at the etchings that portray the original location, these heads sit on these sort of anthropomorphized figures, that is, humanoid sorts of bodies. But the art that Ai Weiwei has produced, they are essentially decapitated. We're seeing the heads on poles. And so it represents this literal separation of the head from its cultural home and from its historic location.
Let me just ask you one last thing. I mean, we're talking 800-pound sculptures, 12 of them for each sign of the zodiac. That's a lot of weight. How'd they get shipped to Jackson, and what was it like installing all this?
Oh, it was wild and crazy to install it, but we got it all done in one day. We had two semi-trucks arrived with all the heads on them and the assorted poles. We had a great big crane and a whole crew of people, you know, really worked remarkably well. And I think that's something in their favor and in the artist's favor, because sometimes these great big things that are moving internationally can be very difficult.
Sounds like quite the ordeal, but totally worth it. That was Jim McNutt with the National Museum of Wildlife Art in Jackson, Wyoming. We've got one last story for you on this week's Artist Touch edition of the program. It's my conversation with the Iranian-American musician Azam Ali. Here she is telling me about someone who inspires her.
Rabia al-Basri was the first female Sufi. She is credited with creating the concept of divine love, which lies at the heart of Sufi mysticism.
Azam Ali and her band Niaz have a new album called Fourth Light, which she says is a tribute to that first female Sufi, Rabia al-Basri.
She was born in the 8th century in modern-day Iraq, but unfortunately, because she was a woman, a lot of her poems as well as the stories about her life really were lost in time and in history.
Yeah, how significant is it that she was a woman?
You know, in many ways, she struggled with the same issues that women today are struggling with in the world, especially in the Middle East, with the status of inferiority. But it just shows that the struggle continues in varying forms and degrees, of course.
Why is she important to you?
She became incredibly important to me because I couldn't believe, first of all, that we did not learn about her growing up. I felt it would be very important for women from our part of the world to learn about women like her. So I just became obsessed with her, and we began doing the research on her, and eventually decided that we wanted to dedicate our album to her because most of our music in Niyaz is dedicated to the plight of ethnic and religious minority groups in and around Iran. So then the idea was, well, let's dedicate the album to the greatest minority group in the world, and that's women.
So, Azam, I'm going to play us out with a track from Niyaz's new album, Fourth Light. It's called Tam-i-Eshk. It's really a beautiful song that you and your partner in Niyaz Logatorkian wrote. What do we need to know about Tam-i-Eshk to understand it?
Tam-i-Eshk literally translates as a taste of love. And it is the one song that I feel really defines this album and the dedication to Rabia. It is based on her poem, which basically said that... If I love you out of the fear of hell, burn me in hell. If I love you out of the desire for paradise, lock me out of paradise. She believed that we have to love just for the sake of love, not out of the promise of heaven or the fear of hell.
A track off the group Niyaz's latest album, Fourth Light. The band is fronted by the vocalist Azam Ali, who I was just speaking with. And that'll do it for this week's Artist Touch edition of Boston Calling. If you missed anything on the broadcast, you can always find us on the web at bbcworldservice.com/Boston Calling. Boston Calling is produced by the BBC in partnership with Public Radio International and WGBH here in Boston. For me, Marco Werman, and the rest of our team, until next time, have yourselves a great week.